The next item on the agenda is consideration of Pueblo District 60's innovation application on behalf of Heroes K-8 Academy and Bessemer Academy. Before we begin discussion, is there a motion on the table, please? Heads up, motion.
I move to affirm the Innovation School application from Pueblo District 60 on behalf of Heroes K-8 Academy and Bessemer Academy.
I second that.
That's a proper motion. Thank you. Second. Commissioner, staff prepared to provide an overview.
Yes, thank you. I'd like to turn it over to Bill Cottonsetti and our Executive Director of Schools of Choice and Innovation, and Alyssa Pearson, our Associate Commissioner, just to give you an overview of this. We told you a little bit about it this morning. But just to set the context.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Katie. So thank you, and it's great to see you all again for my second meeting. Glad to be here. And we have with us today from Pueblo School District, so Superintendent Macaluso, Assistant Superintendent Mori, and Ted Johnson, who is overseeing the innovation work in the district. And so they'll be here today to answer any questions that you have about the plans. Within CDE, the reviews that we have is that the innovation team has reviewed the application to ensure that it's compliant with the requirements of an innovation plan submission. We have confirmed that the district has met all the requirements for submitting the plan. There was supplemental materials that were provided to you, including analysis of the licensure waiver. And I have Alyssa here as well, if there are any questions about the context leading to the plan. At a high level, the plan submission follows the work that has been happening with the two schools and over the past year. And so one of the last requests was to come with an updated innovation plan for the board. And so the plan is here for you today.
Thank you. Superintendent, do you have some comments you'd like to make?
Sure. Good afternoon, Madam Chair Schroeder, Commissioner Anthes, members of the Board of Education. It is our pleasure to be in attendance with you today as we request approval of the innovation plans for specifically Bessemer and Heroes Academy. As you know, that we came before this board a couple months ago, in conjunction with the CDE accountability hearing. And I know that you are all well read, and at that time you received copies of the innovation plan, and we presented an in-depth presentation with details regarding those plans in conjunction with the performance management plan. And so at this time we don't specifically have a presentation, so to speak, but I do have, as Mr. Cottonsteady indicated, I do have Suzanne Mori here, who's my assistant superintendent, and also Ted Johnson, who's executive director of continuous improvement and innovation. And Ted will be able to speak to any elements or components regarding the innovation plan, and Mrs. Mori is prepared to talk to you about our performance management plan partnership that we have with Achievement Network and how that's going. And we are in full operation and had a great start to the school year. So if you have any specific questions or request any additional information, we're happy to provide that information to you at this time.
Great. Thank you very much. Colleagues, do you have questions? Mr. Cotts, thank you for being more detailed about the licensure piece.
Sure thing.
That was my concern.
Did I see a hand up or not?
No.
Would you be good enough to call the vote?
Board Member Durham.
Oops.
Well,
he's excused.
Okay. Board Member Flores.
Yes.
Board Member Goff.
Yes.
Board Member Mazanek.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
Yes.
Board Member Rinkin.
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder.
Yes. Thank you for coming, and
thank you very much.
Thank
very
you.
Much. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks
for being
here.
Thank
you.
Remember, we went to Pueblo.
Oh,
wait for us. So.
Yeah.
You're going to be here tomorrow, too?
No, I was saying, and you have a good drive tomorrow.
Oh.
Thank you, guys. Okay.
All right. No worries.
Well, we can't exactly tell what summer it is.
No.
Next item on our agenda is a notice of rulemaking for the Rules for Colorado School Counselor Core Grant Program 1 CCR 301-74. Is there a motion on the table, please?
This just starts the process, right?
Yes.
The comments.
Apparently, we...
I have it.
Go ahead, Joyce.
I move to approve the notice of rulemaking for Rules for the Colorado School Counselor Core Grant Program 1 CCR 301-74.
That's a proper motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Jane?
Thank you.
Okay,
yes.
Great.
It's second.
Commissioner, is staff prepared to provide an overview?
Yes, thank you. I'll turn this over to Misty Ruth, then, Director of Post-Secondary Readiness. Executive Director of Pathways.
Thank you, Commissioner Anthos.
Sorry.
All good. good afternoon, everyone. So before you today is the Notice of Rulemaking for School Counselor Core Grant. The reason why this is in front of you today is because of the change due to Senate Bill 17068 that requires the department to add additional grantee eligibility to include elementary schools. So this is the only change to this rule, to these rules in front of you today. And so where previously it referenced secondary schools, it's the addition of all schools. So that's what's before you.
Any questions, colleagues? Board Member Rankin?
Could you just briefly describe what that counselor program is?
Sure. Thank you so much, Board Member Rankin. So the School Counselor Core Grant was established in 2008, and it was established to increase the availability of school counselors in secondary schools originally, and for the purpose of increasing the number of students that are prepared for the next step beyond high school, specifically going into college. And at that point, the school counselor student ratio in our state was about 550-1. The recommendation is about 250-1, and so since that time, the counselor ratio in our state has been reduced to about 400 or 450-1 over the past 7 years or so. The other purpose of the grant is to ensure that the highest need schools for counselors in secondary schools at that point in our state had available counselors that they could add to their staff in order to assist students, specifically for career and college counseling.
Go ahead. Follow up. So how, now that we have them in elementary school, how does that relate to career counseling?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So several other states have career school counselors in all levels. As some states are required, some states are voluntary, and in those other states, they do have standards, essentially, for school counselors associated with college and career readiness, and so that's something that we would be looking at as staff in order to help provide districts guidance in these areas and really look at some of those other career and college counseling areas that counselors focus on in elementary.
So as a grant, an elementary school would apply for that if they wanted a counselor in their school?
Yes.
Board Member Masnick?
But it's supposed to be for career planning, career and school planning, this grant.
Career and college counseling, correct.
Elementary school.
So the Senate bill directed us to add elementary school to the rules.
Yeah. And can you give us any background on that? What was the thinking behind adding elementary schools for career counseling?
Sure, Madam Chair.
Please.
So my understanding is that we heard from several districts that there was an interest, and they saw this as an opportunity to also add elementary school counselors, and Counselor Corps has been acknowledged as a high-performing grant program, and that they saw this as a great addition to and a way to add elementary school counselors, potentially.
I have some follow-ups.
Please, go ahead.
First of all, and what's the source of this grant? Who provides the monies?
So these are state funds.
State funds. So it's directed by our legislature, right?
Correct.
And these counselors don't provide just academic career counseling either. Isn't that correct? Don't they also provide mental, social,
So
counseling as well?
The purpose of the grant, of the school counselor core grant, mm-hmm. for this purpose is college and career counseling, and that's the type of support that we provide school counselors, right, in the grant program. School counselors generally, so for example in licensure, have three domains that focus on college and career readiness, academic supports, and social emotional supports.
So therefore a elementary school could request one of these counselors, but primarily use them for the third support reason, the social emotional. Or
so,
do they have to prove that they're using them for
they do.
Academic counseling?
They do, yes.
And one more question. This is the program, and it's, so it's kind of a separate issue, but I want you to remind me that the application process, when schools apply for this grant, they have to agree to participate in the Healthy Kids Survey. Correct.
So this is a different grant program
so
than the grant for.
This is a separate
yes.
grant. Mm-hmm. So the other one is called what?
The other one is called School Health Professional Grant,
okay.
And this one
school
is
health
School Counselor Corps. And I can see how it would be confusing because
yes.
this edition of elementary was added to both grants. However, they are very different grant programs
okay.
and different from one another.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you.
Board Member Flores.
I just want to ask another question, but I'd like to add to that in that there's a lot of research to show that clubs really help kids in the idea of formulating what they want to do later in life. It used to be that the research said that it started in middle school, but now the research says that states that it's really as early as elementary that kids start formulating and having ideas about what they want to do. So I think it kind of goes along with that. The question I wanted to ask is this any part of what the governor of the counselors, the monies that went for counseling that the governor appropriated or the legislature appropriated, but $9.8 million, is this part of it?
Thank you for your question. So I hear that there's two things that might seem related that aren't being discussed that have been talked about now in August and September with you.
Right.
So in August, we did bring forward the School Health Professional Grant, which also has had a new infusion of resources but to the $9.8 million. And that is separate from the School Counselor Corps Grant. There have not been additional dollars added to the School Counselor Corps Grant. And the original appropriation was made in 2008.
Thank you.
Maybe in the future we could do these both at the same time.
Yeah.
Confusion is confusion, and it probably doesn't happen with
us. No, but I mean, they were both in front of us, and we, you know.
Mm-hmm. Board Member Goff.
Thank you. Again, forgive me if you've said this today. The original school counselor grant for high schools primarily. The schools needed to meet certain criteria as to at-risk rates, and all that goes into when you're talking about post-secondary matriculation or barriers that those kids have faced. I tried to find it in here, Misty, and I couldn't, but it could be there. Does the same criteria apply for the elementaries? In other words, is there a minimum number or rate of high-risk kids at risk that have to be present in the elementary level?
Sure. So thank you for your question, Board Member Goff. So part of the statutory guidance to the department as far as the administration of the grant is three criteria that are used to then prioritize a good priority. So that's a percentage of free and reduced lunch, percentage of the students that need remediation, and percentage of the students that go on to higher education. So if those are at or below the state average, then there is a priority given for those schools in the process, for those districts in the process. One of the things that we have seen, not seen yet because this isn't in place, but have talked to districts about is thinking through how they might implement this, and how they see it is really looking at their feeders with their elementary, middle, and high school, and not necessarily thinking of it as independent elementaries that we'd be applying, however, in partnership with their feeder, middle, and high schools.
That would have been my next question, was not that, because we haven't implemented this part of it yet, would there be a look at how many of the feeder area or articulated high schools already have a counselor core program, and then bring some of these elementaries in the same area into it? I mean, it could happen, but I guess my interest today is that a priority? Would it be a priority? Would the department think that that might be something that could be separately studied, even, or followed from a whole community viewpoint rather than individual schools?
So we could certainly take a look at that and get bring that information back to you when there's a hearing with additional information. What I'm hearing you say is that you'd like to know how many elementary schools might be able to be served that are currently participating, have their districts currently participating, right, that would meet the criteria.
I don't want to throw a wrench in current rulemaking and writing, but just a thought about the whole idea of more cohesiveness, perhaps, opening up that possibility for the areas to do that.
Absolutely. And so we would be happy to add that as an edit if that's something that you all would like to do.
Possible further study, further research. Sorry. I don't want to, like I said, I don't want to throw any wrenches in this, but it's thoughts.
Any other questions?
Steve?
So, folks, this is a notice of hearing, rulemaking hearing.
Yes.
So are there any objections? Since there are none, proceed. Oh, I just asked for whether anyone objected, whether the universe. Okay, good. So rolling on to 13.03. Next item is notice of rulemaking for the rules for the administration of waiver of statute. Before we begin our discussion, is there a motion on the table? Board Member McClellan.
I move to approve the notice of rulemaking for rules of the administration of the waiver of statute 1CCR 301-35.
I second that.
Thank you. Commissioner, staff prepared to provide an overview.
Yes, thank you. I'll turn it back over to Bill Cotton. Is it Steady?
Yeah.
I always get that last part right. Cotton Steady, Executive Director of School of Choice. Give us an overview.
All right. Hi, everyone. Good to see you again. This action item is just to begin a notice of rulemaking for waiver by charter schools and waiver from state statute. And the purpose and the reason for coming forward with this is to implement one part of House Bill 17-1375, which was on mill levy equalization. This doesn't really talk about mill levy equalization, but as part of that piece of legislation, there was a section that said, one, there are two parts of statute that are no longer eligible to be automatic waivers. The list of automatic waivers is in this part of the rules, and so the notice is to say remove those two statutes as automatic waiver options. And then one other part of the statute says that school districts have to post their waivers online and charter schools have to post their waivers online. And so it clarifies into this area because this part of rulemaking talks about district waivers and charter waivers. So there's a clause that's added that says both districts and charter schools cannot waive this part of statute.
Thank you. Questions? Ms. Masnick?
So this is maybe more of a question about the statute, The district waivers, the 2.04B, where it requires a school district of 3,000 or more pupils, but they have to provide signatures demonstrating that they have the consent of the appropriate number of the accountability committees, a majority of the affected licensed administrators, and a majority of the affected teachers, and shall indicate how they were determined. And this applies to only waivers in those two categories?
So that,
or does it apply to all waivers?
That is talking specifically to waivers that are requested by the district. So I know we have a crosswalk that shows the three different types of waivers that can be requested. One is when a district is requesting a waiver, one is when an innovation school is requesting waiver, and one is when charter schools. And so the part that you're talking about with the different approvals that need to be in place only applies to the district waiver when the district is requesting.
Right, but what I'm wondering about is what kind of district waivers might make it difficult for the district to meet those, teacher licensure? Do districts ever ask for those kinds of waivers to hire teachers that are non-licensed?
I'm not familiar.
Or is that usually just for schools?
I can go back and research that. I'm not familiar if a district has ever requested that waiver, but.
But this rule, though, is already in statute, right? It's not negotiable anyway.
This process is specified in the statute, yeah.
Board Member Masnick, I think just recently a few districts have requested this, or within the innovation waiver have requested this, the licensure waiver.
Well, and we might, but it was always attached to the innovation plan, right? Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if we might see more of that kind of thing, considering the teacher shortage issue. But this could make it difficult.
Board Member Flores.
I guess I don't understand the waiving for competitive bidding and accepting gifts.
Okay. Yeah, those were both called out explicitly in House Bill 1375.
So if a district is going to accept gifts,
the way that this was put in as an automatic waiver is that part of statute says that the district will adopt a policy for receiving gifts, grants, and donations and competitive bidding. And so when charter schools request that waiver, they say delegating that to the charter school to establish those policies.
Okay.
And so this would still, charter schools would still do that. But rather than having it automatic, they would have to propose a rationale for it.
And that would be for the state board, and then they bring it to us?
In the charter school application, they would say, we're requesting the following automatic waivers. In addition to the automatic, we'll request these waivers, and they may choose to request those waivers as non-automatic moving forward.
Go ahead. This is the second question.
Yeah.
And maybe it's just a concern that I have that the public will know only when it is posted on a website.
Okay.
And I have problems with that because I know that there's lots of people who have problems with that or may not have a computer.
Okay.
And may not know. So it is not really letting the public know, seriously, that it's almost a little hold up your hand. I think it should be in a local paper. I think there should be, certainly there's these committees that school districts have, like school improvement and accountability councils and such.
Okay.
And these people would be able to, I think it should be told to them.
Okay.
And then find a way to make it known to the community. There should be meetings and such, but putting it up, I know this is the legislature did that, but I don't think it's right.
Okay.
I think that there needs to be more, and I don't know. Steve, what? I don't know if you would agree, but I just think that more needs to be done about accountability, letting the public know that this is going on. And we do it for so many other things where they have to place it in newspapers. I mean, then I was thinking about, another one I think that we had here where they had to place it 4 times or 8 times in the newspaper, and I'm thinking, boy, that's going to cost a lot of money. But there's also community papers, and there's all kinds of ways to let the community know. The neighborhood associations and such that I think need to know. I mean, Denver Public Schools, it's like trying to get gold out of an old well or something, because they won't give you any information. And the public, and I mean, I hear it all the time, that they just didn't know that this was available or this was going to happen, especially when the closure of schools.
Okay.
And only a small segment of the population knows, and then everybody gets upset. And guess who gets the phone calls? And it's, I think that they need to do a better job. And if it means going back to the legislature and making it more forceful, I think, to put it out in to the public, to state it, because I don't think this is enough. I'm sorry.
Board Member Goff.
I know it's not the department's fault. I understand that. But I'm wondering if there is some way that we can be upfront and in telling the legislature that this is just not enough.
Board Member Goff.
Mr. Cottonsteady, what we're being asked to do today is to say yes on having a rulemaking hearing.
Yes.
As it applies to the two new parts.
Yeah.
Added so, by whatever bill number, I forgot what that was.
17, 13, yeah.
So what we're talking about here in forthcoming rules to vote on is the new language around gifts, grant to make non-automatic two waivers that have been automatic up to this point.
Yeah.
And so all we're being asked to do today is to say, yes, let's have a hearing.
Correct. Yeah, to open up rulemaking on 35.
Okay.
Yeah.
But overall, the general content of the current legislation on waivers, automatic waivers, will stay the same except for the removal of these two parts of it from the automatic list.
Correct.
Is that accurate enough?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Our intention is just to update the rule to align to statute.
And then Dr. Flores, future conversations can be held around what kind of new language and or new legislation we would like to have.
Well, I'm just putting
considered.
It on the table because
yeah,
I
that's
think
a good idea.
So, does anyone have an objection to the notice of hearing? Board Member Durham.
Method of notification that is on publishing it on the website, is that prescribed in statute or is that prescribed in rule?
I'm pretty sure it's prescribed in statute. The notification method would be consistent with any time we do notices.
So that's the legislature has deemed that to be adequate notice. Is that I see Julie?
It is. It's in statute.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean I personally don't believe that's adequate notification, but that's
thank you, Steve.
That issue's been unfortunately dealt with by higher authorities.
All right.
But I think
we do appreciate your concerns.
Thank you.
We can talk about it when we talk about rules. Are we ready to go on to 14? Mm-hmm. Right now.
All right.
Thank you,
thank
sir.
You.
Next item on our agenda is consideration of the three research requests for student PII, personal identifiable information. Is that the right?
Yes, correct.
Before we begin, I would appreciate a couple of motions.
Right, Madam Chair, can I have a clarification before you read and
Thank you.
Read the motion?
Thank you.
The staff have determined that we would like to take more time on option two before it goes before a vote. As you all had asked for more information, as we reviewed that information, that's something we would like to dig into a little bit more. So we're not prepared to recommend that to you right now. Mm-hmm. So we would like to take that one off the table so you would really only have two research requests to be dealing with today. And Ms. Bohannon can clarify any of that if I got it wrong.
You didn't. You got it quite
Please
right.
Please go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah, I did want a motion. And this is going to be a little clumsy. So I would like a motion for the McCrell request, please, and a motion for the Colorado Youth for Change request. Am I correct?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Do I have a motion there?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, sir. Ms. Madison, do you want to make those motions?
It's working. I might not like it.
Which one are we on? 14.01.
McCrell.
Yeah.
And Colorado Youth for Change.
I move to deny the research request from Northwest BOCES and McRell International to use student PII for research on the evaluation of the system for educator effectiveness and development.
Is there a second?
Second.
Why a negative? I thought we were just going to. Do you want to explain the motion?
I don't find the research compelling or in need of personal.
We want to. Ms. Flores?
First of all, I think that I do believe that teachers and educators, principals, administrators, they're very important in schools. I mean, they're just so important to the lives of schools that I can't imagine denying a motion for more research in this area. And we have already talked about PII, and what they asked is not it will be filtered, and we're not going to give PII that they shouldn't have. So I think this should be a positive. But I understand that we need to possibly, the department needs to look at it some more. But I can't go along with the motion of denying it at this point.
Okay. Board Member McClellan?
Just wanted to confirm my understanding that the students in question, that their families have given consent for this information to be released. Am I understanding correctly?
That's correct. It's an opt-out consent.
Okay. Thank you.
Should we call the vote, please?
Madam Chairman. Oh. Just clarification, we're dealing only with request one.
Only with request one. Mm-hmm. And if you vote yes, then you move to deny. And if you vote no, then we move on to a different motion.
Okay. Now, would you say that again, please?
If you vote yes on this motion, it means you want to deny it.
Oh, no.
Okay. If you move.
If you say no.
If you say no, then we can move on. If it doesn't pass, we can go to a different motion.
Okay.
Okay. Ready? Please call the roll. Thank you.
Board Member Durham.
Yes.
Board Member Flores.
No.
Board Member Goff.
No.
Board Member Mesnick.
Yes.
Board Member McClellan.
No.
Board Member Rinken?
Yes.
Board Member Schroeder?
No. So I now need a different motion on this, please.
We're skipping the second option?
Oh, well, no.
Well, we're not there yet.
Can I read that?
Yes.
Board Member McCall?
Sorry.
I move to approve the research request from Northwest BOCES and McGraw International GU Student PII for research on the evaluation of the system of educator effectiveness and development.
Proper motion. Is there a second?
I second.
Do you want to call the roll, please, Ms. Corcho?
Board Member Durham?
No.
Board Member Flores?
Yes.
Board Member Goff?
Yes.
Board Member Mesnick?
No.
Board Member McClellan?
Yes.
Board Member Rinken?
No.
Board Member Schroeder?
Yes. So now if I could have a motion, please, for Colorado Youth for Change request. Do you have a comment? Okay. Board Member Flores?
I move to approve the request from the American Institute for, or is that the one that we're not doing?
No, we're not doing.
Okay.
It's on page.
Well, on page.
Three. Okay. Thank you. I move to approve the research request from the Colorado Youth for Change to use student PII for research on the evaluation of a Colorado youth for a chance initiative.
It's a proper motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you.
Comments?
Questions?
Could you please call the roll?
Board Member Durham?
Yes.
Board Member Flores?
Yes.
Board Member Goff?
Yes.
Board Member Mesnick?
No.
Board Member McClellan?
Yes.
Board Member Rinken?
No.
Board Member Schroeder?
Yes. Our next item is the update on the Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA State Plan. Commissioner?
Yes, thank you. I will be turning this over to Pat Chapman, Executive Director of Federal Programs, and Alyssa Pearson. And we may have some other folks, Marie Hutchton and Nazim Hajri Nelson. And this is the ongoing communication around our federal Every Student Succeeds Act plan and the feedback we have received from the U.S. Department of Education and presenting some options to you moving forward based on that feedback. So am I turning this over to you, Pat, first? Okay. Or,
all right. We're right here, aren't we? Perfect for a discussion.
Is that making you uncomfortable?
No, it's actually really
nice. Would
you
like to move back a little?
Maybe just a half a foot. So we are here today to provide some clarifying information regarding the feedback we received from the U.S. Department of Ed regarding our ESSA state plan and the plan approval process, and then to share some options with you with regard to how best to move forward after receiving their feedback. Just to ground you a little bit to kind of ground you in where we are in the process. As you know, we submitted our plan on May 9th. In mid-August, on the 9th and the 11th, we received feedback from the U.S. Department of Education, both in a phone call and in writing. They requested that we submit a revised plan within 15 days. We felt, given the feedback, that it would be best to request an extension to submit a revised plan. We did that on August 24th. We received confirmation from them that they received that request and are okay with us taking some additional time to work with the board and stakeholders in identifying how best to respond to their feedback. They said okay. We indicated that we would be in a position to submit our revised plan in late October. So today we're here to share some additional information with you. It's a little bit deeper information with regard to the nature of the feedback that we received. On the 21st, Alyssa and Ozzy and Marie will be convening the accountability work group, the ESSA Accountability Spoke Committee, along with the HUB Committee, to talk in detail about the feedback that we've received and to pull together some feedback that we will share with you at your October meeting, and then we'll go from there. Just a little bit about the areas that we received feedback on. It was primarily related to accountability, the how we calculate the achievement indicator and participation for the accountability achievement indicator. They, during a phone call, I believe, with Alyssa and the U.S. Department of Education, they raised the issue of K-1 and K-2 schools, how we will calculate and what we will use for accountability for those schools. Some information about our long-term achievement goals and the interim targets. So those are the areas that we will be looking to you guys to provide direction. Then there are also a couple of other areas that we will discuss more in more detail over time. That is the other indicator that we're allowed to utilize under the new ESSA statute, and then long-term goals and interim targets for English language proficiency. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alyssa and others to go into detail. Sorry.
Thank you. Okay, you all, I know it's the afternoon, it's hitting, isn't it? We're going to wake everybody up with ESSA. Or help you have a nap time, one of the two. Before we go any further into the details, I just want to do a little bit of framing, because I think as we start talking about the U.S. Department of Ed requesting or telling us, giving us direction that we need to go in a certain direction to be approved federally, there's been confusion about state versus federal systems and how well aligned they are already. Already with what we wrote in our plan, we have distinct state and federal identification. We were able to bring our state and federal system together quite closely through the waiver process when we had an NCLB waiver, not entirely, but the closest that it's ever been. With the ESSA plan that we submitted, it was already a bit distinct. Remember we talked about those, we had those kind of Venn diagram circles, and that we showed that there's not a perfect overlap in identification of schools under ESSA and schools under the state system. So ESSA requires identification of comprehensive lowest 5% of schools, and we've been able to align that identification with our state system. But then ESSA also looks for schools that have low graduation rates and that are identified based on the performance of individual disaggregated groups, and those are targeted and additional targeted. And those areas, those kinds of identifications, are identifying important challenges that schools have, but they are not aligned with how our state system all the time identifies schools and districts. So we are already at this place where we know we're gonna have different identification. The way we wrote the ESSA plan to begin with was so that we could use the baseline data, that same data that we use for the school performance frameworks, to identify schools federally, so to use those same calculations. I think where we're going to get into the conversation today is that base calculation level, there's an option to looking at that differently. So it will veer it off, or it could have the potential to veer things off a little bit more, but we are not at a place right now anyway with the ESSA plan that we're in perfect alignment state and federal. So I just wanted to kind of start with that. We're going to go probably spend the majority, depending on how you all want to spend time, on the achievement and participation calculation. I think it's where you all have the most interest, but you know, if you don't have a lot of questions, we can move through that more quickly. Mr. Durham's questions about the participation rates and kind of the distributions of those, we just wanted to follow up and show that here before we get into the details so you can know what the data looks like a little bit more. Oh, that's super teeny. Sorry. Thanks, Mikey. I'll read it out loud, but it'll also be up there bigger in a moment. We looked at the English language arts participation rates for schools, just used English language arts as a kind of as an example. 289 schools in the state had participation rates below 85% in English language arts in 2017, about almost 16% of our schools. There were 393 schools, or about 21%, that had participation rates between 85 and 95%. So they'd have that kind of low participation flag there or indicator, but they weren't as low as, you know, below 85%. And then we had 1,097 schools, or about 60% of our schools, that are at or above 95%. So it's kind of the high-level distribution. There's 57 schools, N size is too small to report what that participation rate was. So that's kind of the distribution of what we're looking at in terms of where schools are falling in terms of percent of students participating. That's high level. We can get you more nuanced if you guys want more nuanced data, but thought that would help. Thank you, Mikey. Thank you. So after we talked with you all in August, we told you we were going back to the U.S. Department of Ed to get some real solid clarification from their perspective about what they saw was the need for us to fix or to change in order to have an approved plan. What they told us is that when we calculate achievement for purposes of identifying schools for those ESSA categories, we can't exclude parent excusals from the denominator. We can't exclude anybody like from that denominator calculation. Basically, once you exceed that 5% of students not participating, they have to be in the denominator. They have to count as a non-proficient rating in some way or another. So they were very clear about that. So it's about the identification of schools under ESSA. We have flexibility as a state in how we report the results and our state accountability system. So according to what they shared with us, this is about ESSA identification of schools. We have flexibility with reporting and with our state accountability system. So I think a good way to kind of show all these components is to do a little crosswalk. Thank you, Murray. You're like, you've got a screen right here. You don't need to look up. There's a federal component, and there's a state component, and there's thinking about achievement calculations, you know, our proficiency kind of measurement and participation. I'm going to walk through the different requirements and where we're at currently. So in terms of achievement for the federal law, again, when we exceed that 5% of students counting as non-participants, they have to be counted as non-proficient. That's what the U.S. Department has said. So again, I think we went through this example in August. If you had 100 students in the school, 50 tested, 50 didn't, what the feds say is the calculation would be 50 divided by 95, because you can have your 5% non-participants, you'd have an achievement rate of 52.6%. And we would use that not necessarily for reporting, but for calculating which schools get identified under ESSA. So currently, you know, for the state, we do things differently. In our mean scale score calculations, we only use students that actually have a valid score on the assessment for our calculations. So a kid that didn't test for whatever reason, we have the participation rate, and it's very clearly marked right next to the achievement. But when we calculate what that mean scale score is, we're only including kids that actually have a score. So again, it needs to be taken into consideration. You've got to look at that. You know, if you've got half your kids tested and 100% are proficient, you have to know that half of them did not test. So we know how half of the students did. We don't know how the other half did. So you still need to, you know, look at the data carefully. In terms of the participation requirement, the U.S. Department of Ed confirmed or clarified for us that their minimum requirement for how states hold their schools and districts accountable, just their schools accountable for participation, is by doing what's in that achievement, the federal achievement square. That's all we need to do, is do that calculation the way they want. When there were regs in place, before the regs got removed, there was all these different options of what we needed to do. Those regs have been removed, they are not in place, and they've clarified that the minimum requirement is just to do the calculation the way the law is saying to do the calculation. Currently in our state plan and our ESSA plan that we submitted, we have some other ways that we included, because at that point we thought we needed to do more. So we included requirements around improvement planning, reporting, communication tools that the state would provide, and program reviews, specifically around the accountability participation rate when we remove the parent excusal. So not the overall participation rate, just that accountability participation rate. And then finally, in terms of our state system, what we do for accountability, and we talked about it a little bit earlier, is we lower the rating one level if schools or districts don't meet the 95% accountability participation rate. That's what the choices, you know, that we've made as a state to do there. Again, we also add those descriptors that we talked about this morning. So for purposes of today, what's in this yellow-orange color, that's what we need to address for the U.S. Department of Ed. That's what they're telling us in our state plan. We need to respond to this concern about how we're calculating achievement and what we're doing there.
Let me, yeah. Can I just clarify? Mm-hmm. So the option that we had earlier of just lowering the accreditation rating, that was a state option. Mm-hmm. And the feds even then required a zero, or did our waiver allow us to do that for NCLB?
The language around the 95, like when you exceed the 5% participation, that is new language. That was not in NCLB. So okay. This is a new requirement, so, or a new way of holding everybody accountable.
Right.
In NCLB, what there was, though, before the waiver, when we had adequate yearly progress or AYP, if a school didn't make, district didn't make 95% participation overall, or for even one individual disaggregated group, it did not make AYP. So there was this very,
right.
You know,
and they,
all or none.
The scores were counted as zeros.
The scores of the non-participants were not counted as zeros. They were counted in the participation rate as a non-participant, but when we calculated the percent partially proficient or above for AYP, the non-participants were not in that calculation.
Thank you. So I know you didn't answer this. May I?
That's okay.
Do you have a question?
I do. Okay. I know that last time I had asked about the Fed rule, which was that parents have the right to say no if they chose that their kids not take a test. Okay, that was, and then we followed, and then our legislature followed, meaning when we followed the same rule, that was when we voted, and then our legislature voted that they would not be counted, or schools would not be censured for what parents, the decision that parents had made. Okay, but that was the order. So now they're saying that that doesn't go. I mean, even if our legislature says that.
So can I clarify a little bit the policy path that we were on? And Joe, feel free to jump in if you want to better explain this. You all made a motion in February of 2015 that said CDE don't hold districts accountable if parents choose to opt their students out.
Well, I think we said don't censure.
Yeah.
Don't hold them liable yes. for what parents,
yes.
for the decisions that parents made.
Yes.
And that's because there was a federal law still on the books when we made that decision that was federal. The state did the same thing.
So there's still a law in ESSA and the federal statute that says that parents have the right to opt out, or rather that federal law does not change state law on parental rights to opt out. But the federal statute and USDOE's position is that question of parents' rights doesn't control the question of what happens as a consequence to districts and schools. And on that particular question, I think the statute's quite clear that USDOE's position is not ambiguous here. The statute's not ambiguous. They're pretty clearly right.
But our state statute is not ambiguous.
So can I clarify in our state statute? And then, mm-hmm. So what we have in state statute is not around school and district accountability. It's around having a policy so parents can know how, if they want their students not to take the test, how they do that. And then it goes on to say, you know, schools and districts cannot put an undue burden on students that want to take the test, nor can they encourage students not to take the test. So it's about student and parent.
Students.
Yeah, they can't penalize students whose parents choose to opt them out of the state assessment. But it's all about students. It does not talk about the school or district consequence at that level. It's just silent on it.
Board Member Durham.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I correct that we would, for purposes of distribution of funds and that sort of thing, we would use the federal rule and use that now in terms of assessing treating those scores as zero and then assessing, and the aid would go that way. The only thing our current policy does is prohibit us downgrading a school's performance rating one mark if they fail to meet 95%. That's really the only thing at question, is whether or not we impose that penalty. Is that a fair statement, that wouldn't change distribution of funds from current methodologies? Is that correct?
So I think that's helpful for me to hear you say, because I think that's been an area that we haven't been totally clear on exactly where you all mean in terms of liability. In terms of, if you're asking in terms of if we took the federal policy and put that into place, what would happen? Is that what you're asking, Steve?
Well, have we ever changed, really? I mean, have we always calculated which schools and districts are entitled to funding? It maybe doesn't affect funding at all. This is just a penalty question.
It doesn't
affect Title I funding as to the distribution.
Yeah. So it doesn't affect any state funding. None of our state accountabilities affects state-based funding. And in terms of federal, it doesn't impact the general Title I funds that go to the district. We get about $10.5 million in school improvement funds from the feds to direct to those to the schools that are getting identified. And so based on, and we can talk about this in the options more, but based on how we identify those schools, we may get some schools in that identification that we wouldn't have otherwise. What the U.S. Department of Ed has said to us is that when we run our comprehensive lowest 5% list with the calculations they want, we can differentiate the schools that are in that list because of participation from the ones that aren't. And then we can have different supports for them. So we could say, yeah, you 20 schools fell on this list because we don't know how your kids did. You're not the priority for the funding to support improvement because we just don't know how you're doing. We're going to prioritize the funding for these schools over here that we know, based on participation, we know kids are struggling.
So there's at least no reward for non-participation.
There's no reward for non-participation.
In other words, you've actually, yeah. Since they're not under consideration because they have low performance.
I think that is up to our discretion to say if we want to prioritize the funding to them or not to them based on
what
they're
identified. I don't think there should be a reward. I just don't think there should be a penalty. But nothing really has changed in that the federal law recognizes a student's, a parent's right to opt out. Mm-hmm. State law recognizes a parent's right to opt out and goes one step further that says that there are no penalties that can be imposed by the district or the school.
That's our rule. That's not the law.
No, that's the state.
That's the legislature.
And ours then says you can't penalize the district for that which they cannot control. Mm-hmm. And so nothing fundamentally is changing, other than the only thing that would change is that we would impose a downgrade of one performance rating. We would reduce it one mark, which would then incentivize all the school districts to violate the statute and try and penalize students for not participating.
Which
they already do, but at least we've minimized it to some extent. Is that a fair outline of the issue?
Well, we don't have to do that for the state. Calculations.
The decrease in the participation.
Yeah.
Your board rules have a requirement that participation is taken into account in the overall rating, but not in the percent of points. So you've got something in your current state board rules. You all clearly have authority over that and can change that if you want to do that. But right now, it's your decreased rating is around the accountability participation rate, so you're not holding anybody accountable for the parent excusals.
Right, if we maintain that, if we refuse to penalize districts for that which they have no control, then they're threatening to withhold funds. That's really bottom line. Because we can't get an approved plan. If we can't get an approved plan, they're threatening to withhold funds.
If you interpret the calculating those students as non-proficient non-proficient is holding the district liable. I think it's your interpretation. So if your interpretation of holding the district liable is downgrading the rating, the feds are not telling us we have to do that. All the feds are saying that we have to do is count those students as non-proficient.
So that, but that then has the, that will certainly have the effect of, could have the effect of downgrading them more than one.
For the federal, for the federal identification, not for the state. They're not telling us anything about our state system. They're telling us for those federal comprehensive and targeted and additional targeted identifications. That's how we have to calculate things. You all are still, so everything in green is up to you
do
all.
Do those get reported anyplace?
We have control over the reporting. We will let, we definitely need to let districts know schools that are identified. Do we have to report a list of the schools identified? Okay. But we can differentiate on that list those identified by because of participation and those that are not identified for the other reasons from the actual
but
performance.
Just a one moment.
Madam Chair.
Board Member Sorry. Lincoln.
This is not real clear to me.
Okay.
No. But let me just look at an example. Let's say a school, a district even, the top kids opted out. So their scores are lowered. They're non-proficient. So more federal money gets directed, earmarks that school as being, and then those top kids are back in the classroom, but the money is going where?
So we have discretion on whether or not we send the additional money to those schools that are even identified because of students not taking the test.
So even, so, but ESSA, federal money,
sorry,
is,
we have discretion.
Is still our discretion?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
it might render some schools eligible for school improvement funding that otherwise wouldn't be eligible.
But we
in the awarding and allocating of those funds, we can take that into consideration and direct the funds to those that have been, I guess, more correctly identified for improvement.
Okay.
How do we know?
I think we would say we know the ones that are struggling that have the participation right there. The ones that don't have the participation, we don't know if they are or not, right? So it's really about, there's some unknowns. We may be identifying them, we may be misidentifying them, we don't know. But the ones that do have the participation rate, I think we feel pretty confident that we know that they've got challenges.
I think one of the things that they, the feedback that we got from the USDE is that how you do state accountability, your state accountability system is up to the state. But for the purposes of implementing the federal statute, these are the rules.
Yeah.
Reporting.
So, reporting and to count those non-participants, the parent refusals, as zeros in effect and those kinds of things. So that's what's clearly
Mr. Chairman, is that reporting to the federal government or reporting generically?
Steve, publicly next. Reporting
publicly.
The results.
Everything in green up on the slide is where you all have some discretion and ability to change things. And the U.S. Department of Ed is not telling us to do anything on that. That's all of what you all want to do, what's in statute and rule two. But that's where we have got discretion. It's really just the yellow-orange section that's where we're getting the feedback from the U.S. Department
of Ed. And the question I want to ask, and actually I'm asking, is this true? And I'm going to make your district a comparison to my
Go
district.
Right ahead.
Okay, so there's Denver Public Schools and then there's Boulder. Boulder, of course, has a large number of white students that opt out. Denver has a large number of students, especially minority students, that don't opt out. So that would mean that priority would be given possibly to Denver, because Denver has a good rate of kids taking the test, whereas Boulder does not. So priority would be given, and there's a need too, the big need that Denver has a larger number of minority students, and the need is there, and they score lower than do the kids in Boulder. So would I be right in my assumption?
Yeah, so I think when we run the results, if we run the results the way the U.S. Department of Ed is asking us to, and we're working on it, we're not there yet. So once we have the data, we can be a little bit more informed on all of this. Run the results the way the U.S. Department of Ed wants us to. We will look at, you know, the calculations that we do now, the way we do it, and then the way that they want us to with the non-participants counting as zeros. we'd pull out the schools that are identified in the categories because of the zeros. Like if they're identified there but not there, identified because of our normal calculations, and look at the difference. So if Boulder schools are popping up on the lowest 5% list just because kids aren't taking the test and we don't know how they're doing, we would have that, we'd move them to one pile. We'd keep the schools that would be identified based on the actual performance and actual participation in another pile, and then we can prioritize the ones that their actual performance is low and warrants support and put those supports
the
there.
The dilemma
so my
is,
let me finish. So my last question is that Colorado would still get the monies for ESA. Those are not going to be taken away. The monies are not in question.
We need an approvable plan.
Okay.
With the U.S. Department of Ed.
On that issue.
There's a few issues that they have. This
right.
is the one that's
but that,
the hardest
but,
to resolve.
But on but, that, if we yeah. work it out, it's mm-hmm. okay.
The dilemma, Ms. Flores, is that Boulder and a number of other districts that have very high achieving students, they also have Title I schools where 60 to 80% of the kids are on free and reduced lunch. And when they don't have the kind of participation that for the particular schools, that information is lost and those resources are lost for those students. So the dilemma is in the groupings of kids
right.
within the districts. And that is all, I believe, all over the state and in several of the other high achieving districts that also have congregated poor
okay.
kids.
I was
and
just
that's what we lose.
I was just making a gross yeah. kind of assumption. And also, I think there are statistics, that metrics that you could use to show that it was kids who score high, usually because of past grades and past years, that would show that. And I'm not saying that
I'm just pointing out the fact that when you look at it globally, this is why we disaggregate and why we look school to school. Because if you just look at the big picture of the districts, you don't
that's
get,
what I,
get
and,
the detail
exactly,
information.
Exactly. I'm saying the same thing. We're talking about
Ms. Masnick.
Is it possible, either for you, Pat, or Alyssa, or whoever, to explain this? DOE wants us to report that way, mm-hmm. which has an effect on the funding, correct? But if I'm hearing you right,
yeah.
and this is what I'm hearing, and yeah. I would like you guys to put okay. it into a nicer package that makes more sense, but I'm also hearing that the state has some ability to parse those numbers out so that they know how much of that non-participation is because of opt-out and how much is just non-participation. And based on what we know statewide, you know, as a state, we may be able to direct the monies in the right.
Yeah.
So I just want to know if that's what I'm hearing, that regardless of what the Department of Ed is asking for, does the state have pathways and ways to make sure those funds are directed to the right place?
Yeah.
And is the problem that we don't think that the Department of Ed will approve our plan? Or what is that plan?
Let me move forward because I think we'll get to it. But let me just clarify the beginning of what you said. What the U.S. Department of Ed is saying, it's not about reporting. It is about identifying schools under ESSA for support, that we have to do the calculations the
but
way they're saying.
But the reporting determines, right?
We can report the data in ways to be more clear and transparent about it, about what it's actually reflecting. We don't have to report the individual calculations. I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense. You'd want to report the data that's behind the identification.
Right.
But when we're talking about when we put out our achievement reports, and we can report achievement by showing here are the percent of kids that participated, here's what the ones that did participate, what their scores are. We can do that the way we want. We don't have to give this misleading piece of information when we report the achievement rates of 52% of kids are at benchmark when actually 100% of the kids that tested are okay. meeting expectations. So we don't need to do that for reporting. We just need to do that for identifying schools for support under ESSA. Does that make
okay.
a little more sense?
And keep going. So
okay.
We
so let me
identify.
Yeah. If I can go through the options, I think we're going to get to the rest of your
okay.
questions.
Okay. So let me clarify but, yeah. one thing before we do.
I think
it's important to note that because of the situation you described, Dr. Flores, where in Boulder, generally high-performing students don't test, and their rating might be lowered. Mm-hmm. And in Denver, there is they may very well meet 95%, if not they're close, because right. essentially everybody tests. Mm-hmm. Because of that particular issue, no money that should go to Denver flows to Boulder. And that's currently true. And would be, and I think would continue to be true, that regardless of whether or not we take any action. Mm-hmm. So there's not money flowing to places where it doesn't belong. This is issue, the only place money comes into play in the entire discussion of this issue is you have to believe that for the first time in recorded history, the U.S. Department of Education would withhold funds if we don't dance to the tune they want to play. That's really the issue. I don't personally happen to believe that that's going to occur, whether we take all the action they want or whether we take none of the action we want. Now, everybody can have an opinion on that, but at least historical perspective is certainly on the side of likely not seeing any funds withheld because of the pure politics and optics of that, and I think it's much less likely now than it would have been a year ago. So that's really the only issue. All this debate is really about whether or not we're going to have an approved plan. And if whether or not we have an approved plan really affects anything, I'd like to find out. Because I don't think it does, and I think we ought to manage what goes on in Colorado in the best interest of our students. And the legislature has made it clear that it's in the best interest of our students not to be penalized if their parents opt them out of testing, that they shouldn't be held up to ridicule, denied the opportunity to participate in extracurricular activities or any of those things. That's really the issue. And the issue is, are we going to uphold the intent of the legislature, who I think clearly has the basic authority in Colorado education, or are we going to allow Washington to dictate what I think is a very important policy? And I think that's really all it boils down to. And perhaps the saddest part of this is the policy, when you go to the meetings where there are federal people, they tell you the reason for the policy is they believed that school districts, in order to raise their scores, would discourage free and reduced lunch students from taking the test. Obviously, that hasn't happened. What's happened is parents who are very concerned about whether or not their students benefit from this test have decided they should not take it. So even the intent of what the federal statute was for, the intent of the federal statute is not being violated by this policy, because there is no evidence whatever that anybody is encouraging poor kids not to take the test. If anything, it's quite to the contrary. So it's the federal policy is bankrupt on several levels, that being the most, and I think that being the most significant. The policy is completely useless, because it tries to deal with a problem that does not exist. And I don't think they were ever concerned about good students opting out. As it has been made clear in a number of meetings I've attended where the federal officials have said in no uncertain terms, we really don't care about white students in Boulder. This is a Civil Rights Act. It doesn't have a darn thing to do with it. Well, the Civil Rights Act, the civil rights of all of these students are being protected by the existing law. No one is encouraging a violation to encourage those people not to test. So the question is, are the parents going to have the right to make the decision they believe is in the best interest of their kids? And I appreciate what you all are trying to do and trying to avoid a confrontation, but I don't, as long as the legislative, if we're going to take some action, we ought to notify the legislature that the statute they've passed, not allowing a penalty, is creating a problem, and whether or not they want to reconsider that. And if they reconsider, we should reconsider. But until that happens, I don't think we should reconsider our existing policy. Thank you.
So, Mr. Durham, I'm going to say this one more time. Boulder does not have 100% high-achieving kids, and my point was that when our staff has the opportunity to distinguish between schools that should have the funding for free and reduced lunch kids or low-achieving kids, or in particular special ed kids, which, by the way, there are efforts to keep them from taking the test. Your information is not 100% correct there. It makes it really difficult because we really are not seeing the picture. That's all. I'm not suggesting any kind of changes,
but
it's not as ideal as you describe it.
But I don't think that the staff is still out is misallocating funds. I think they are.
I think they're doing the best they can with the information that we provide.
Well, and I think they're getting more than enough information to make those decisions.
So let me talk through the high level. These are kind of big categorical options. Clearly, there could be a lot of nuance within these and a lot of other options, more kind of nuanced options out there. But we wanted to pull together like the three big ones that we saw and then let you all have conversation about that. So there's one, we could adjust the achievement calculations for federal purposes only. So that orange check section, do what the U.S. Department of Ed is telling us we need to do on that and do that only for our federal calculations. You all could do that for federal calculations and then choose to do it for state calculations too. It's an option you have. Or the third option is stay firm on our calculation policy, don't make adjustments to our ESSA plan, and then see where things go from there. And then additionally, clearly you all in all that green section, you have flexibility. If you want to do anything with the way we do any of that, you can. That's just not anything you need to do for ESSA.
Can I jump in?
Yeah, please.
And Board Member Masnick, I don't know if this helps, but I'm just trying to clarify. I'm trying to simplify option one, which is all the stuff we just talked about, and my team will jump in if I get this wrong, is that for ESSA, they want us to calculate. They want us to calculate using students as a zero if they don't participate, just for the identification of the lowest performing schools. It does not mean we need to change our ratings.
Right.
Okay, so I kept hearing people jump in on ratings, like lowering a rating level or lowering. Option one, going back one slide, would not mean that we would have to change our accountability framework ratings, all the things you saw earlier today. All it would mean is how we put the pool of schools and districts into a support pool. And then we could identify the criteria with your help, if you'd like, to say how that money is allocated.
I think that was what I was trying to say that I thought I was hearing.
Yes. I think, and I just wanted to be sure because
our accountability.
Right.
Okay.
Right. This is not about, and this is where
the purpose of it versus the effect of it, and how we can make those decisions.
Right. So the ratings, our accountability ratings, are not in this mix.
Right.
Okay.
I mean, it is the claim from staff. Is the claim that there'll be nothing published that will cause the public at large or the residents of a particular school district to believe their students performed worse than they actually performed because you used in the calculation you have, you gave 50 students a zero. And the answer is there are going to be publications that contain this information. The districts are not going to like that kind of publicity, and they're going to try and do something about it, probably in violation of the law, which forbids them from penalizing students because, frankly, even with no penalties, I get reports on a very, very regular basis of coercion and penalties to students. And the problem is the legislature didn't make it a misdemeanor or a felony to violate that law, so the only option is to find a parent with enough money to see if they can spend $200,000 or $300,000 suing their school district. So we're the only protection they have.
So you're correct, and I was saying was the rating on the accountability framework would
right.
be lowered.
But right.
there would be other places they could find the information with this calculation.
Correct, and you can bet they're going to be that information is going to be well publicized.
But Mr. Durham, wouldn't a school board that allows parents to opt out simply explain that different calculation? And say, based on the preferences of our parents, this is a whole different measure. This is not an accountability measure. Based on that, this is a measure in order to help identify students who seek federal, for whom we seek federal funds for additional money. I don't see that districts will get all in a lather about it if it's explained well.
Well, I guess we could find out by seeing if there's some funds or grants we could make people ineligible for if we receive complaints about them treating students and violating their rights under the statute. I suspect that would, if I were to make those motions and bring those rules forward, would not get a majority vote on this board. So the answer is what a district will and won't do is, I think, pure speculation. But the serious reality is the only place parents have to go for protection is right here at this board. If a district decides they're going to play hardball with parental opt-out, unless you have $300,000 or $400,000 to go throw around for litigation, you're all done and you just sit back and take it.
Board Member Flores.
Is it possible, and didn't the Department, U.S. Department of Education, offer this, that we can have a report for them, according to their rules, a report for us, our state, according to our rules. So that's an option. If that's an option, then we should take that. I mean, say, yes, we'll take the option for reporting for Caesar, what Caesar wants, you know, what Caesar needs and wants, and then one for us, for our state, according to our rules. And would that be just too awful? Would it be too much work for the department?
I think that's what we're here to discuss today. Just to Board Member Durham's point, So what we're talking about when we're saying rendering schools eligible for funding, the calculations that we're talking about lead to the identification of some schools for comprehensive improvement and some schools for target improvement. Those schools have to write an improvement plan, and they do need to consult with the parents and the community in the development of that plan. So it will be known to districts and schools that they have been identified for support and improvement. So that may lead to greater discussion within the community about why and so mm-hmm. forth, and that might not be a bad thing, but there are being identified for both support and improvement and do have to write a plan as a result of that designation.
Thank you.
So to dig in a little bit more on option one, that would be, just as Dr. Flores said, adjusting the calculations for the S identification, but keeping our state system exactly as it is, We've received indication from the U.S. Department of Ed that that would lead to an approvable ESSA plan. It would also allow us to keep our state system intact in the way we calculate. Some cons to that, or concerns about doing that, is, like you talked about, there's going to be somewhere where we need to do these calculations and do some reporting, so it may misrepresent schools with low participation about their performance. And it doesn't, you know, we'd have, that's where we'd make that divergence from the base calculations between state and federal. There are some things that we can do to mitigate it, like we've already talked about, and really think about. We can put those schools that are identified because of participation into a different category. We can label them differently. We can talk about them differently. We can prioritize them for those support funds differently. We still have to report, write a plan. So that's option one of what we could do. Option two really gets at this, well, you could change the state system too. I mean, we're just putting all the options on the table. We're not advocating for anything in particular. So we just tried to kind of, the big ways that you all could go. You could align both, right? You could have a consistent set of data that's used. We're still going to have that not perfect overlap of schools and districts, but we'd have consistent data being used. We'd probably have an approvable ESSA plan based on what the U.S. Department of Ed has said. Some cons of that is it does really compromise the ratings for schools and districts with low participation. It puts them into this category that we don't know if they should be there or not, right? And then again, resources which we can do some mitigation of, and attention is set to schools that may not need it. We just don't know if they do or not. And we don't see that aligning with the approach in the direction that you all have given us. Mitigation, again, we can do some of that differentiation between the schools for participation issues and schools for actual performance. And then finally, the big kind of bucket of ideas of options is to stay firm with our policy and send our plan back to the U.S. Department of Ed with no changes and staying. We're still sticking with this. That would uphold your approach and consistency to your approach. It would ensure that when we report data, it's, you know, clear and transparent. This is the percent, or this is the actual achievement of the kids that participated, but here's the participation rate. Likely it means we won't have an approvable plan. That triggers a whole process with the U.S. Department of Ed, which Joe has done a lot of research on and can talk through what that would mean if we submit our plan back with no changes and then they decide it's unapprovable. And then potentially, who knows what would happen, but there's potential loss of federal funds on that. Mitigation for this is, if you all wanted to explore that more, you could also explore it under the path of getting an approvable plan first and then going back and asking for a waiver or an amendment to change what we have in place and kind of do that. Let's get ourselves approved and then let's go back and revise and try and get our systems more aligned with each other. So that's an option as well.
So there's waivers still?
There are waivers that you can still ask for. What the U.S. Department of Ed has told us, though, is that they're not considering those until states have an approved plan. So you got to get yourself to an approved plan and then you can come have a conversation with them about waivers.
Board Member McClellan.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate you mapping out these options for us, and I just wanted to say that I would be interested in getting the perspective of Mr. Peters from the Attorney General's office with respect to possible ramifications for option three. And I also would be interested in knowing what federal funding and for which students in need would we potentially be placing in jeopardy were we to go with that radical option. It would help my understanding to know just what we would be putting at risk and which students would see their federal funding that they need placed at risk and how. And I'd also be interested in the financial impact or the potential financial impact in increased legal fees for the department should we go that route.
Mr. Peters.
So I can't answer anything specific about legal fees. I haven't done that kind of math. In terms of the possible ramifications, as Ms. Pearson said, there's sort of two different ways to do the legal fight. If you go and don't, you know, if you fight now, you know, in the plan approval process, as a theoretical matter, all of the Title I funds can be placed at risk. If you lose, that would come at the end of litigation. And there's a long, extensive process that goes into that. Separate from that, ESSA has another penalty provision that allows the portion of funds that's set aside for state administration to be withheld. I tried to figure that out. I think it's about $1.5 million. But you know, don't hold hold me to that. In theory, they can hold that back without any process whatsoever until they get us to cave. As Ms. Person said, there's also a post-approval process. You come back for plans or for a plan amendment or for a waiver, and there would be no money at risk because you would have an approved plan in place. You'd be in compliance with their position and trying to move out of it.
Madam Chair, if I may just jump on that, and Joe has really very much been the point person from our office on this, and I'll continue to be. But one piece I did want to add is to make clear that we're not talking about a moment where the board has to decide at the October meeting whether to jump off a cliff or not. I mean, this is really, there is a process that, you know, if you all wanted to take a last shot at that proverbial line in the sand and say, here's what we want to do and why, and then if the plan were formally rejected, because what we've gotten right now is a more of an informal feedback process, there's still an opportunity fundamentally to capitulate, for lack of a better term. So there are some intermediate steps. If one of the things I know, as Board Member Durham mentioned, is, you know, sort of an I think they're bluffing, I guess that would be the moment when you would find out. But
well, and you just said in theory.
Yeah. Board Member Flores.
That's down the road.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, just a minute. Go ahead.
Just as a follow-up, thank you so much for the information. I would be very worried about placing all of our Title I funds at risk. And I also just want to say, I think we're all wanting to act in good faith and recognize that one of the goals of the accountability system is to help us understand where improvement is needed. And so having these gaps in the data leaves those who would benefit from that identification and the help that it might bring kind of in the lurch. And certainly I don't think anyone means to leave those kids in the lurch. I would certainly hope not. So to that end, I think that making these tests as relevant as we possibly can to the parents who are having the greatest degree of heartburn may be a positive step in the right direction, so that for example, basing some of our high school tests on a more college preparatory model is giving some of these parents things that I know where I live, parents are going out of their way to pay for privately anyway. So there clearly is a value in allowing children an opportunity to get comfortable with college preparatory or college entrance exams generally. So I think those moves are taking us, I hope, in the right direction so that these tests are relevant not only to the children who need the help in the form of federal funds after identification of the need for improvement, but also those who are choosing to opt out in greater numbers. So thank you very much for bringing this before us.
Board Member Flores.
Well, I don't think that, I think that Board Member Durham is correct. I mean, in saying that the monies wouldn't be compromised in going to the wrong people or the wrong kids or the wrong schools who don't need it. I think you're right, because we do know that it's more white kids who really do well, but whose parents think they're wasting their time on taking this test. I think those are the kids that mostly don't take the test. So in a way, I think we shouldn't even take up your time and go to the Attorney General and ask for all that time. I mean, I really think that we should go with option one. And I think that if we think about it right now, that is basically the wise thing to do. I mean, is it possible to take a vote right now on that issue? Well, I think that parents have the right.
Dr. Flores, we're going to get some input from the HUB committee. There's a sort of a process. We will address it in October, but we are looking for some further input from the folks who've been, the accountability folks who've been looking at this, the
right.
Whole ESSA plan.
Well,
so it wouldn't be appropriate for us to be voting on this right now.
Well, we know where they came from. I mean, these are people that stated that they didn't want kids to
Board
come
Member
up
Flores.
To come up to
Board Member Flores.
To level.
Let's just let the
to
process.
Grade level. And I don't know. Maybe I just don't have much respect for a group that doesn't believe that kids
Board
can
Member
come
Flores, please don't
to
do this.
Grade level.
Please don't do this. I forgot who's running the
Okay, we're about to pass things on.
Okay.
So, again, like you just said, Chairwoman Schroeder, this is just information today. We're going to get more feedback on the 21st. We'll bring it back to you in October. We would really appreciate your direction in October. The U.S. Department of Ed would like us to resubmit by October 23rd if we're ready to do that. If we're not ready to do that, we're not ready to do that, and that's okay. But okay. That's the timeline we're kind of looking at and hoping for.
Going to get more feedback from the HUB committee?
Yeah, we're on September 21st. We've got a joint accountability work group and HUB committee meeting to talk about this and some of the other issues that we're going through today, just to get there deeper. You know, we're going to spend a whole 7 hours with them digging into this. Luckily, you guys hopefully you'll have just an hour and a half today.
Board Member Goff.
Thank you. Does this jeopardize? I don't want to use that word, but does it impact our timeline for implementation? I mean, the farther we go back in this fall, well, on the other hand, if we get a federal budget, that might be big news too.
So
we don't have to do that, but I would just, for everyone's logistical peace of mind, well, how are we doing with that? Because the farther we go, is there an ultimate drop-dead date this has to be approved? Or just so we're ready to implement in 18-19? Is that all
the U.S. Department of Ed said this is for the 2018 identification. So starting in 2018, beginning of the 2018-19 school year, for identifying schools based on the data coming out this school year, that's when our ESSA plan takes into effect. We've got some flexibility for what we're doing for this current school year in terms of support.
It still seems like it would be a more amenable situation for us here if this was known. If we had a good handle on schools that needed comprehensives that we want to target for either of the two categories before the year starts, because all of that ties in with not only that, but we've got an assessment season coming up and the beginning of a new performance framework.
I think we've heard from the schools and districts that they appreciate knowing what and how they're going to be held accountable as soon as possible into the school year.
Okay.
Yeah, I've heard concerns from districts.
So,
just something for you all to take into consideration.
Concern about parents, too.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to move on now. I'm going to pass clicker to Marie, and talk about some of the other issues that the U.S. Department of Ed wanted us to resolve that we really need some policy direction from you all. Again, not today, just to try and get your feedback on it for going forward, or for your information on it for today for going forward.
But you don't want us to ask questions about it today, right?
Oh, you can definitely ask questions today. You just don't need to make a vote or anything on it today.
And hopefully these are not quite such contentious issues that we're going to be getting
but
into.
You never know.
Don't worry. We can find it.
Probably so. We'll see. So the first one that actually came as a bit of a surprise to all of us when we were talking to the USDE was that we need to have a process for identifying K-2 schools for the comprehensive and targeted support and improvement. In the past, because of our state system, mostly looking at data from grades 3 through 12, we have not actually given ratings to the K-2 schools. So this is a bit of an unexpected challenge that we are facing. So they specified that we do need a mechanism to identify those K-2 schools. And thinking about the available data that CDE has on K-2 schools, it is pretty limited. But we do have things like the percent of students identified with significant reading deficiencies on READ Act assessments, the percent of students no longer identified as having a significant reading deficiency on READ Act assessments, chronic absenteeism or attendance that we'll be collecting starting in 2017-18. We also have English learner proficiency growth. It's a pretty limited list. We are, as Alyssa had said, getting the HUB and AWG working group back together on the 21st to sort of dig into these different possibilities and
hopefully to get a recommendation for them on what they think would be meaningful identification for this. I mean, it's a pretty small number of K-2 schools that we have. There's 15 of them. So it is a small, very specialized set of schools.
So this is only for schools that are strictly kindergarten through second grade?
Exactly. Sorry, yes, so this is only for kindergarten through second grade schools, because as soon as a school has, you know, third grade through 12th grade, we have additional data for them, so this is only for those schools that we really don't have data that we use in the traditional performance frameworks.
And there's 15?
15.
We had written our state plan basically to say, you know, they don't have the data that we're using to identify, so they won't be identified, and the U.S. Department of Ed didn't like that. They said you can't automatically just say they're not identified.
So. Have any of them been Title I schools?
Yes, some of them are Title I schools.
So I get it.
Yeah.
So,
Board Member Flores.
Thank you. So wouldn't it be easy to identify these students who go to the feeder school, which is in third grade, and give that option?
Yeah, that would be another option. That's a good suggestion, that we could just look at the performance of the feeder school and connect that back. Sometimes it's not as clean as a single school, you know, mapping to one other school, but we can look at that.
It's only if they go directly to one school.
Right, and usually there are feeder schools. That's why they're called feeder schools.
So that's something that we can also include in the discussion that we have with the Hub and AWG and bring back for you in October to see sort of what our options are. Mm-hmm.
We didn't take a break at the time we had planned because we were ahead of schedule, but now I'm thinking that people are wiggling in their chairs and maybe we should have a, could we keep it to 7 minutes, please?
Sure. It's a good break point.
All right, we stopped at long-term achievement goals and interim targets. I think we're on page 24.
Yep.
I still haven't figured out who's in charge. I guess it doesn't matter if somebody will. Marie?
Yeah, for the moment, I'm the presenter.
Marie, please move forward.
All right. So another topic that we discussed with the USDE was the long-term achievement goals and interim targets. And so just to remind everyone, we did include the ESSA statutory language, you know, that says we must establish ambitious state-designed long-term goals, which shall include measurements of interim progress toward meeting such goals, and then sort of, you know, some additional details, which says that we must take into account the improvement necessary on such measures to make significant progress in closing statewide proficiency and graduation gaps. So the expectation is that, you know, groups that are farther behind need to make faster progress in order to catch up with that piece of it. So in our initial ESSA plan submission, we had included normative long-term targets where all student groups were expected to reach a baseline 53rd percentile of academic achievement within 6 years. And so this wound up creating some quite ambitious targets for certain groups, and then for other groups, they were not particularly ambitious. So USDE has clarified with us that the long-term achievement goals do not need to be the same for all disaggregated groups. That had actually been a requirement under the now defunct regulations, but when we were having all those original AWG and Hub conversations, those regulations had been in place and had very much shaped our thinking. And so with the rollback of those regulations, I think we're like, oh, there's new possibilities that we were not aware of previously. And so now we just have to have the same methodology for creating the long-term goals and targets and the same timeline for all of our groups. So that gives us a little more flexibility, you know, timeline and methodology.
I don't understand.
So in our original thinking, we thought that all of our students had to get to the same end goal within the same point of time. Now we can create a methodology where they can, we're going to get into the details of this, say, half the distance to a certain achievement goal within a certain period of time. So we're going to get into some of the details of what they were really meaning. They were really looking for a gap closure methodology. So, we did clarify with them that we probably do have the option to continue using the current Colorado targets. Oh, actually, I lied. I skipped ahead. Sorry about that. So this is the slide where we just wanted to say that you know, they were critical of some of our targets, you know, not being too ambitious and others being a little bit too ambitious. And so, you know, sort of this is the picture that we had originally presented to the hub that caused some consternation, in that when you were looking at the Asian and you know, white students, that they would actually could go down and still be meeting our long-term achievement goals, and that was, you know, problematic. And then also when you're looking at the children with disabilities, that they have an extremely steep, you know, trajectory that would be basically unattainable. And that, you know, maybe that is not the best thing for our long-term targets as a state.
But we are still going to expect all kids.
We will still expect our kids to get to the academic level that they should be. I mean, we're still expecting that. Maybe take a little bit more time, but targeted level of academic.
Can we get through this and then bring your questions?
Well, because it's important. I think we forget. I just would like a response. I mean, we're expecting minority kids to get to a proficient level of academic learning, just like everybody else, because they're not. And the gap stays there, and we talk about the gap and closing the gap and such, but we don't do anything. And I think a lot of it has to do with attitudes. I think many of our teachers and many of our administrators, and maybe the whole system, does not believe that kids can get to minority kids, kids of color, Mexican-American kids, Latino kids, and black kids cannot get to proficient levels. And if we're going to really give them the opportunity, an opportunity to succeed, then we need to expect that, and we can't be blasé and say, oh, well, you know, they're minority kids. Or just say, well, all kids can learn, a platitude like that. And
Dr. Flores, can we finish this, and then I value what you have to say, but this is what they want to present to us, is a process to get all kids.
But as a high-level answer to your question, we are absolutely saying that we want all kids to reach the same academic standard. It's the path and the targets that are reasonable, attainable for them to get to along the way.
You're already saying for them, a target for them.
For all students.
Well, yes.
And I think
not platitudinous.
Yeah, I think also the differentiation, and we don't have to think through if this all makes sense, but this is about system targets, like school and district and state level. It's not about saying what we want for an individual kid. Clearly it rolls up to it, but this is looking at how do we move systems along from where they are. I think there's a lot that we can do and that we do. You look at the purpose of Title I, it is about individual kids and getting all kids to meeting the standards and the expectations, especially in Title I, focusing on the kids that are furthest from getting there. How do we move them and get them to that level? So I think that might be a little bit of a helpful differentiation. Sorry.
Yep, no, it's good. And I think there is some flexibility in the long-term targets. I think that the minimum target we would have for all of our students is to get students to proficiency. The question comes in when you already are proficient on average, when you're looking at Asian and white students, and finding targets that are also meaningful for those groups as well.
Absolutely.
It's more like what they said was allowable was that Asian students have to maintain or increase performance. That our previous sort of expectation was that Asian students who were already at 82nd just needed to be above 53 and they felt that that was not rigorous enough. The Asian students should stay at least at the 82nd percentile or increase over time as well.
Mm-hmm. So I can define that as what allowable is.
Yes.
I think what was hard is when we were going into this before, the understanding was that all students had to be at the same endpoint. So if we said 53rd for, if we said 83rd for everybody, we would have, it would be great if we could get everyone there. Clearly we want that, but the trajectory to get there would be really challenging from where we currently are with what we currently are doing in our system. And so the USD clarified that, no, you don't need to have that same 53rd for everybody. Those groups that were already ahead, you could do something different for them.
Exactly, yeah. So you can say that they will maintain or also make progress based upon where they're currently at. So that is one of the options we have, you know, specifically for the Asian and white students. And so in the handout that we just gave you, the option one top graph shows you what that would look like. So you can see that we would still be maintaining those high expectations and high targets for the groups that are currently below sort of the state expectation of the 53rd percentile. And then for the two groups that are already outperforming the state, they would maintain their current level of performance, and that would be considered a success, and they would be, you know, reaching their goals.
That's like No Child Left Behind.
Except No Child Left Behind said 100% for everybody.
Yeah, right? That's true.
But it did say.
By 2014.
Yes.
We're there.
So, yeah. We're not saying that this is what we have to do. These are sort of options that are up for discussion. We can also choose, you know, to have more rigorous targets for Asian students and for white students. I think that these are kind of all on the table now. And that's what we're going to have the conversation with the Hub and AWG about. But this is just sort of to conceptually ground you in where the conversation is and where we think we are going. And so then the other methodology, option two that we have on here, is to rework our target setting methodology to use that gap closure approach, which seems to be what a lot of other states have put forward in their ESSA plans. And so this is an expectation for a disaggregated group to reduce the gap between their current achievement and then a target level of achievement. And so the target could be the proficiency rate of another group, such as, you know, white or Asian students or all students, or it could be a performance criteria on the underlying assessment, such as, you know, the proficient cut score on the CMAS assessments. So there is again some flexibility and some places for us to figure out what targets we want to be aiming for. What I will say is, having looked at some of the other states, we might need to revise the timeline for our goals. Most of the other states have set very, very ambitious targets, but their timelines are also by 2030 or maybe later. So the fact that we had originally, you know, set a 6-year timeline means that sort of getting to, you know, at 100% proficiency is probably not going to happen in 6 years. So that's another thing to consider, in the conversations we have with the Hub, is do we want to adjust that timeline? So, as we'd said, so we are having, we have meetings set up for the Spoke and Hub members, and we'll get to revisit all these target setting conversations. So they're going to, you know, review our presented options, discuss these pros and cons and potential data impacts. We're going to spend, potato impacts.
You want to avoid those.
As long as they're chips.
That's true. Nice. And sort of think about some of the alternatives that we might have. You know, if there's something that we have not thought of or that the other states haven't done, we are definitely open to alternatives. And then hopefully from them, we can get some recommendations for revisions for our ESSA plan that we will then bring back to you at the October board meeting that will be a little more specific instead of just sort of this high-level conceptual options.
Mm-hmm. Board Member
Forrest. So, could we say that maybe 60% of Latino kids would be proficient? 60%, because not all white or Asian kids are proficient. I mean, collectively, they get to 82%. So if we could, because we know that we can. I mean, I know that we can, because I've done it. So
there is the possibility. I think that that's the conversation that we're going to have with the hub in terms of, do we want to use a percent proficient or advanced metric, median scales or mean scale score, some of the other options that we have to try to figure out what is most meaningful to represent all of our students and their current levels of performance, and being able to measure how much improvement they make over time towards our end targets. So I think that those are conversations we're going to have in more detail with the hub and the AWG. So then sort of the next, moving on to our areas for future conversation. Oh, I'm sorry. I also didn't know this.
Board Member Gawne.
Well, quickly, I'm looking at this one. And at the top, well, on each, but there's a children with disabilities. Mm-hmm. Is that looked at separately from special education, special needs, or other categories?
The children with disabilities in this case refers to students who are on IEPs. So it is a subset.
Okay. So this would this or not include kids that are that have special support for dyslexia, or if they are autistic, may not be not necessarily have to be with a disability, but they have some other thing. And then the other part of that is what if it's separated out, what about is this purely or primarily demographic groups, our typical subgroups? I'm going to get asked again, and I want to talk about where are the high achievers, meaning specifically the GT kids. And so what are we doing about goals for them as far as achievement levels within the time frame, whether it matches everyone else or not? It keeps coming up. And
yes.
I think it's important if we try to get a start on really where can they go.
So, I mean, I think the challenge that we sometimes have with this is, within ESSA, it's actually very specific which disaggregated groups need to be included in these, target conversations. And it is, economically disadvantaged students, individual race, ethnicity categories, English learners, and students with disabilities. So GT is not included in this disaggregated group. We have done some previous work and continue to do so. We sort of what would be the impacts for disaggregated students and looking at, their current performance and setting meaningful targets for that group. I would probably not recommend that we include that in our ESSA state plan, but I will leave that open to someone else up here to
guess I would just say that there are gifted students in each of these groups.
That's true.
It is true. They're not being called that explicitly.
At the same time, it's kind of hard to talk to people about where they can find that specifically brought out for that particular group of kids, and all this.
But it must be collected.
Talking about lots of other tangential areas as well.
Must be identified in our accountability system, because I see data for GT kids all the time.
So it's reported. We have quite a bit of reporting for GT students, but it is not included in the accountability system, either the state or the one that we're proposing for the feds.
But we report it.
We report their information with the achievement results and the growth results, absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
District by district.
District by district, school by school, and actually the Gifted and Talented Unit at CDE has worked with the UIP team, and they have a UIP addendum, but they've also made a whole data report that really disaggregates the gifted and talented data. So they look at gifted and talented overall, but then they also look at representation by race, ethnicity, and FRL, and really dig into it when schools and districts have the
sense to be able
to do it.
I've seen it,
but
I don't remember
where
I saw it. Do you want
to?
Well,
can
you direct some stuff to us?
Yes, thank you. That would be good.
I've totally seen it.
I mean, there's been some great steps forward made about being more specific to it. And I think with everything, like everything else, it depends on what the end number is. Yes. So when you have these real small communities, it could be that the number of GT identified kids is a large percentage. Mm-hmm. But because the number
small
is
count.
Small, a lot of times that is never really well known. But you're right. I think just want to keep it in mind. You know?
No, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And Jane, I think you also asked about students with disabilities. So the students in that category, like Marie said, are the students with an individualized education plan with an IEP. So they're getting services through special education in their school. It does not include students with a 504 plan, and that's about as far I can talk, but Pat may be able to get into more detail if you need more detail.
That's where I leave to.
Okay.
Yeah, we'd have to get
but there are definitely, if a student's getting services because they're autistic and they've been identified with needing an individualized education plan, then they would be included in that reporting.
Okay.
So IEPs, what about severe special needs?
Those students would have an IEP.
Yeah.
I was just thinking if you could add anything.
Okay, so now moving on to the areas for future conversation. English language proficiency, long-term goals and targets. So at the August State Board of Education meeting, the board indicated that a planned study session on English learners will provide better context for reviewing the work for you guys. And in the meantime, the board was comfortable with CDE staff reworking the targets based on historical data, and then including language in the ESSA plan that the board will be revisiting these goals and targets in the coming year so that we can update the historical data with, you know, the new data that we have. So we are sort of working on doing that right now. We are bringing back together the culturally and linguistically diverse education stakeholder group, and they will provide recommendations for revising our current English language learner targets in the ESSA plan using historical data. The accountability spoke and the hub group will review CLDE recommendations at that September 21st meeting. And then CDE is planning to update our ESSA plan with recommendations based on this historical data for resubmission to USDE, and then have our study session with you guys in October. And then we'll incorporate discussion of these ESSA EL targets as appropriate in that conversation. And then in the future, we can revise and update our ESSA plan if the state board would like to adjust the goals and targets that we have put forward. So it's kind of we're in this gradual process of making incremental changes and sort of getting information available and making everyone sure everyone's on the same page. But we do know that it is going to take a little bit of time. So then I'm going to pass this back over to Alyssa to do the final component that we.
So this is another conversation area you have some flexibility, and we don't need to make any decision now at all or with the resubmission of the state plan either. But the U.S. Department of Ed has indicated that for the academic achievement indicator, that is only English language arts and math. That's how they define it and how it's defined in statute. So science we can include in our calculations, but it needs to be listed as an other indicator. So based on that, then we have some options with our other indicator. We can continue to use science along with chronic absenteeism and dropout rates, which is how we've started to redraft the plan. We just kind of move science around and the points around, and it won't change how we do anything at all. It's just how we're writing and presenting it in the plan. We could use science instead of chronic absenteeism, the elementary and middle and high school or elementary and middle level where we have chronic absenteeism. So we've got that option. We can continue working on those longer-term options for additional measures, if there's other additional measures we want in there. So there's just some flexibility there. It's just something to think about. We'll talk with the accountability work group about this more. They've been thinking a lot about those longer-term options. That was something that we wrote into the ESSA plan, that we would be continuing to have those conversations and figure out if there really are other measures we'd want to build out long-term in Colorado for accountability.
Board Member Frost?
Yes. I'm just very concerned when we add absenteeism, especially concerning one of my districts, which is Denver, which has choice and no transportation. So there are These are real cases. And Sunday, I just kind of almost wanted to do this because of, you know, there were all these parents who were saying, I have to take my kid to this school, this kid, this school, and this school. And, you know, there's only two of us, like two parents. And how are we going to take three kids to three different places? So, I mean, choice does present a problem in Denver when transportation is not provided for kids. So it's a double whammy. So I wouldn't even think that, and I would imagine that that may be a case in other places, but particularly in Denver. And we hear this, not only do I hear this personally, but we read about it. And I just think that science is important. Absenteeism, I think that would be a kind of a double negative on poor kids.
And that's something for you all to discuss, whether you want to keep that in there or not. And we'll get feedback for you from the Assembly Work Group and the Hub conversation, and then that's something you all have plenty of time to think about and discuss where you want to go with it.
Is that group looking at what's often referred to as the California model? Where the way I understand it is that they are looking at a lot of indicators, sort of a dashboard to be presented to families, and that part of the dashboard information is what actually goes into their accountability measure. And then the other parts are things that, in fact, the district has control over that they want to share with the parents. But because it may not be in every district, or it may be very difficult, it may be a very subjective measure, et cetera, is still disclosed. But it's all sort of a part of the same report that goes to parents. Joyce and I had a chance to hear, I think you were there too, to hear from the chair of the state board in California, and they've been working on this for some time. He did say they really are struggling with figuring out the weights to give the items in their accountability measure, but they're still working on it. Something to watch. But I think there's some folks here in Colorado that have a similar vision, and I'm not sure if they're organized and if they've joined the
work group.
The work group?
We definitely, the Student-Centered Accountability Project, which is probably the most organized in the state, they have membership on the Accountability Work Group and have shared what they've been doing. I shared that as we've been talking about other indicator. I think what's challenging with the federal aspect of this is what's in statute requires the same measure for every school across the state. So what we're hearing a lot from the state is we want some choice. We want to talk about our local priorities and have that highlighted. I think that's something we can talk about as a state. Federally, they're saying, nope, you got to have the same thing across the board.
Right. So, but while we're doing the federal, we ought to be able to have the conversation. Because I think there are people who believed that we could have different measures for different districts. And that's become a great frustration to them. That doesn't mean that we can't figure out a way to allow districts to share with their communities items that they think are really important.
Absolutely.
And most of them are inputs rather than outputs, but nevertheless, they're seen as being very valid information.
Madam Chair.
Oh, Board Member Durham.
Before we conclude, can I ask a few background questions? Mr. Chapman, so when we're talking about the potential federal funds that we might conceivably lose, we're talking about Title I funds, is that correct, or is it broader than that?
We're talking about funds that all the funds that are part of the Every Student Succeeds Act, so Title I, Title II, Title III, Title IV. Most of the requirements reside in Title I, but all funds are.
Can you tell me approximately how much money that is in Titles I through IX?
Title I's about $152 million, Title II's about $23 million, and Title III's around $9 million, and then Title IV's around $4 million. IDEA, I think that's around 50, there's multiple parts of IDEA, and I'm kind of looking back at folks. I think the main IDEA Part A is it's around $150 million also, and then I think there's another $50 million pot of money for C or something. But it's around $200 million.
So total?
$200 million for IDEA and around $200 million for ESSA.
So 150, so it's $350 million in those particular federal grants.
No, it's around $200 million for ESSA and around $200 million for IDEA, so around $400 million.
$400 million. So we have $400 million at stake. Now, according to the U.S. Census Bureau 2013 Public Education Finance Table 1, the federal contribution to Colorado education is $896 million or 7.93% of all the money that is spent in Colorado on students. 42% of the money, 42.06% of the money is state, 50.01% is local. So of the $896 million, a little less than half of the essentially 8% would be jeopardized. So we're talking something less, right around 3%, give or take, of all state funding would be in play.
And just to clarify, I don't know that. I think it might be possible for us to be in compliance with IDEA and not and out of compliance with ESSA.
So, you know, talking maximum numbers to appease Ms. McClellan. So we're talking maybe 3% maximum of state of all funds that are spent in the state. Now, would you say that the State Department of Education spends at least 3% of its resources trying to comply with this?
You get money.
Well, I think that certainly this plan development process has been lengthy.
On an ongoing basis, we have 500 employees. 3% of that would be, 15, if my math is right. So you think we use the equivalent of 15 FTE in all departments? A lot of the accountability work is related, at least in part. So 3%, fair estimate?
I would think it I guess it kind of depends on how you define being in compliance. So I think that developing our plan and getting that plan approved is separate from being in compliance with the law once the plan is approved.
All the monitoring,
but there has certainly there's a fair amount of time spent.
Wouldn't be outrageous to say more than 3%. Do you think if you went to a big district like Denver, you think that they might answer the question that they spend 3% of their resources attempting to comply with all of the things that are put on them by ESSA and its predecessor acts?
You
wouldn't want to speak for them, but it wouldn't be a completely outrageous.
But I do think that there's a feeling that there's a fair amount of time devoted to being in compliance with.
But they're getting the money for it from the feds.
But if it's a break-even proposition, which is where I'm going, Dr. Schroeder, if it's a break-even proposition, one would question whether all of this effort might be better spent trying to actually teach children something as opposed to comply with federal law. And I think the statistics and the numbers are a lot more valuable in analyzing the value of a federal program than emotion that's attached to, oh my God, we might lose some money. I've talked to a few administrators over time that would be happy to give up the money in exchange for not having to do all of the things. Yes. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if every member of the board hasn't heard that at one time or another from one or more districts. So I think when we lament the law, potential loss of federal funds, I just like to keep one thing in mind. There is no free lunch, and I'd be willing to make a bet that if we could accurately calculate compliance costs throughout the system, that taking this federal money is a losing proposition for Colorado students. Thank you.
Now you sound like my dean at the University of Nevada.
Yeah, I don't know him. I'm sure he's a brilliant scholar.
Board Member Rankin.
I want to go back to the slide on 34, where it says USDE has clarified that the academic achievement indicator limited to English language arts and math. And I know we work at our academics, and we test kids on the SAT test, which is evidence-based reading and writing. And supposedly, this test, SAT, that we use is based on the standards that we have. How does this work in with the English language arts and math? Or
that's a good question. We would need Joyce to get into the details of what's in the assessment, and unfortunately she's not here. But I think that evidence-based reading and writing, it's just how SAT calls English language arts content.
I know, but it interests me that they include writing. I mean, we include writing in that, which must be part of our standards, and that they don't have that there. And to me, that kind of goes together. But
that the federal law doesn't say writing. I think when generally, Melissa, help me out. English language arts is considered those reading and writing skills.
So listening. So this definitely. I mean, we can use a lot of our information from what we already have to meet this requirement.
Yeah, so our state assessments, the CMAS, English Language Arts and Math assessments, absolutely meet this requirement.
Okay.
The differentiation is just that, you know, when you look at the school performance frameworks or district performance frameworks, under achievement, we have English Language Arts, Math, and Science, right? They're saying you can't, when they talk about their category, science doesn't go there. Science goes in their other indicator category instead. Doesn't change how we're going to do our calculations.
It's just a technicality with regard to how the statute's written that it clearly states English language arts and math.
And to go back just a little bit from what we talked about earlier with K-2, if reading and math are our key focus, all of those tests, assessments that we give up to that, they should meet the requirements of ESSA, should they not?
Which assessments? The third through eighth grade?
The K-2. Remember we were having a hard time evaluating, but we do have assessments there in reading?
We don't have a single statewide assessment.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That answers my question.
Because in reading, the district picks. Board Member McClellan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I had a very small technical question. I know that on this supplemental handout and the accompanying chart within our packet, that children with disabilities includes children with an IEP. Does that also include children with a 504 plan?
No.
Oh, it does
only,
not?
Only students with an IEP.
Okay.
That's what, how it's been defined.
504, please remind me.
You guys are, can I?
It's, you can qualify for a 504 without having an IEP, but I was trying to find stuff on the internet and I couldn't get enough information, so we'll have to get back to you.
Students may be exited from an IEP, and instead of just being fully, you know, you're off in general ed with no support, they may be exited to a 504 plan, which is more monitoring but not as quite in-depth as having a whole full individualized education plan. Is that you want to add to it?
It can include an accommodation such as extra time for testing if a child has a focus challenge, for example.
Thank you.
Okay. Can you wrap it up?
Yeah, so this is timeline like we've talked about. Next week we'll have that joint accountability work group hub meeting for those that can attend. There was a challenge with scheduling because we were trying to have that meeting soon enough that we could get feedback back to you for the October materials. The case superintendents meeting starts that same day, but the superintendents that are involved have reached out to and let them know that we'd be happy to have a conversation with them separately. Then we'll have the board meeting with you all and looking for your direction so that we can resubmit the plan by the 24th. 23rd is
they
the 23rd.
The 23rd.
I thought we had initially said the 20th, right around then. So after that board meeting, we'll write like mad, hopefully, and then get it back to them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for all your hard work.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Next item on our agenda is consideration of our 2018 regular state board meeting dates. I'd like to have a motion, please.
Move we adopt
Thank you.
I second that.
Great, thanks. Is there any discussion? I'm sure you all looked at them. Do you see any problems? All right. Is there anyone opposed to this motion? All right, we have 2018 dates.
Thank you.
So we can publish them now?
Yes.
For folks?
Yep.
Believe it or not, there are people who want to know.
I know.
They're not in this room.
The next items are all consent items. So we're not item 18. The last item on our agenda is a discussion on student safety and parental notification. Board Member Durham, since you requested that this item be placed on the agenda, would you like to begin the conversation?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a motion, actually, and I'll start with a motion, which is to...
This is an information item today, sir.
Maybe I'll just make a request then of the Attorney General to review the statutes that have been enacted by the General Assembly relative to student safety and the responsibilities of this board to provide information relative to student safety and see if any of those acts would lend itself to rulemaking authority that would allow us to do something similar to the rule that was passed, I forget the year, 2011. And just to, there's a copy of the rule in your board packets, but just as a quick reminder, it says, after consulting with the charging or arresting criminal justice agency, the school board or charter school shall notify all the parents of the school in a school in which an employee or former employee of the local board is charged with one of the following offenses, and those are then on page 3. While that list is a little more exhaustive than I probably would personally support, there are certainly some of those things that I think merit that. And I think given some of the recent issues that have come up, particularly in Cherry Creek schools, the lack of notification has come to the attention of a number of us, and I think it's appropriate that the board take a look and see whether or not it might be time to revisit this issue. And I will say that in lieu of that, I believe there's likely to be legislation on this topic would probably get us to the same place that we were. And I think that given the recent events, that legislation will be much harder to defeat than it was after the 2011 incident. So I would request that the Attorney General conduct that review and see if there's any rulemaking possibility for us in that regard. Thank you.
So we will bring that back again as an information item, or if you feel that we have some leeway, perhaps draft a rule that you think would withstand evaluation. Does that sound right, colleagues?
Thank you.
Does that mean we would use this new rule up until the time legislation is passed to change it?
This is not a rule.
It's a repeal.
No, the one that you were just talking to her about. That's my question.
I think it's based on your recommendation, actually, Ms. Tolson.
Yeah, if we have the authority, then we could proceed. If we don't, then we would rely on the legislature enact the appropriate statutes.
Good. Okay. Any other questions, comments about this topic? All right, we are rolling. So at this time, State Board Member reports. Do I have folks who want to make a report? Ms. Masnick?
I just want to say that we are meeting in Burlington because Burlington is in the 4th Congressional District, and since my time on the board, and I represent the 4th District, since my time on the board, we have had a couple of meetings in Grand Junction in Ms. Rankin's district, Director Rankin's district. We have another one in Pueblo, also in your district, and I have been nagging for a few years, haven't I, that we need to have a meeting in the 4th District and preferably on the Eastern Plains.
Good for you.
At a small or rural district. So I am very pleased that we are finally here in the 4th District. and thank Burlington Superintendent Satterley and their board. They've been very helpful in getting this set up, and I feel a little bit like I'm at home because I grew up about an hour east of here in Northwest Kansas, so this feels a lot like home. So anyway, that's my report. I'm really great. Pleased to be here. So
thank you. Board Member Goff, do you have a report?
Well, I would like to invite anyone who
where is CD7?
Lakeville? Denver.
We could find a place.
Is it not on? Oh, I know. You're right. Kearney Middle School, Adams 14, made a great making and the beginning of a great road ahead for them in improvement. They have recently held a nice big celebration ceremony with their whole community to observe the movement from priority improvement school and improvements steadily upward toward it. Performance. So for Adams 14, it was one piece of very encouraging news for them to receive, and with the promise that other schools are about ready to jump to that that level as well and continue on. I have been out and about in Adams County quite a bit, which is usual, and somewhat more lately in Jeffco. Observing the start of the school year, there seems to be a good, healthy, motivated, optimistic tone out there in our schools. And as far as communities coming together and appreciating what hard work there is to be done right now, it feels generally like we're all on a good track for moving some things ahead. I will be speaking next couple of weeks to two different types of groups about general terms of what's going on with the state, what is the state board doing these days, and what some thrust of our work is, but also some of the most important issues for Colorado in education. So anytime, anyone, feel free to just throw out a thought to me at any time, and I'd really like to be able to incorporate what I hear from everyone about each person's picture of what is a very important thing we're talking about now and kind of bring it all together a little bit. So that's primarily it.
Thank you. Mostly. Board Member McClellan.
I just wanted to say a special thank you to our staff for helping to get me prepared for a speaking engagement. I gave an update to stakeholders in which they asked me to report on what's been happening on the board and what we're going to be covering. And I was to be speaking for an hour, including questions. So as you can imagine, I wanted to make sure I had lots of information so that I wouldn't be repeating, let me get back to you on that, if they'd asked me questions at the granular level. So thank you very much. It went well. And I was able to answer questions without having to be vague or tell them I was going to get back to them. So that went well, and I appreciate it. I also wanted to reiterate my congratulations, especially to Aurora Public Schools, to Superintendent Munn, and all the way down to the classroom level teachers who worked hard to make a difference in achieving their progress and improvement. And so I congratulate that district on getting off the clock. That's terrific. And then all of that information that was shared with me by staff, which I so appreciate, is going to come in handy because I will be giving an update at my regional CASB meeting next week, not for an hour, I'm sure. And I also look forward to joining Commissioner Anthus this month when we meet with stakeholders in Aurora. So thank you for joining us out in my district in the 6th Congressional. And also, Ms. Mazanek, if you would extend our thanks for the hospitality here in Burlington, especially for the baked goods. That really made it all the more special to visit your district. Thanks.
Board Member Rankin.
Thank you. The first thing I'd like to bring up is something I've brought up in the past, and that is our financial transparency icon on our CDE website. I've been trying to promote that throughout the district. I think it's so easy for parents to get on and understand some of the finance, and if you need more information, you can auger into the site. I met with Bright Bites the other day to talk about some other things and tell them how excited I was about the site that we have. Before it was when it first came out, it was on the front page, the home page of CDE website. It now is buried more in the finance area, and I would love to see that icon come back to the front page until people get very familiar with it and how to find things within CDE. So I would recommend that CDE does that. It would be very helpful. I also want to again give a shout out to Superintendent Mike Epright at West End Schools for the improvement he has on the performance frameworks and the celebration he's going to have in his district, which I plan to attend. And then I have a slide up here to show you an opening, September 31st, an open house and ribbon cutting for the Roaring Fork School District's newest school, Riverview. And I think there were probably 200 parents and students that came. It's a project-based school, dual language. And it was really an interesting layout for a school, and it can be incorporated for other uses in the community. Very interesting, and I wish them all the best of luck, and I'll be keeping up with that. It was part of a $122 million bond issue that was passed in 2015.
Wonderful.
And then I'd like to move to Dubec, and this is part of a trip I took down there, and I wanted to show you their log cabin schoolhouse.
I love it.
It's located at High Lonesome Ranch in Dubec, outside of Grand Junction. And their plans are to turn it into a museum. Back in the 1800s, Dr. W.A.E. Dubec was looking for a location for a ranch, and the town itself of Dubec was historically a location where wild horses were prevalent in the surrounding lands, and they were rounded up and sold. And that was in the late 1800s. It's a great area. I recommend anyone to visit Dubec. It's good. They're also noted in 2014. It was the first incorporated town in Mesa County to approve the retail sale of recreational marijuana. Next slide is the inside of the schoolhouse, and that's one of the desks that's there and the old potbelly stove where the kids kept warm. Kind of fun. And then I just have to digress on just a little bit. This is a dude ranch now, and we stayed there for 2 days, and my husband and I did a little fishing, and I just have to brag just a little bit. This is a 23-inch long.
Wow. You caught?
Trout that I caught. And if you know anything about fishing, this is on an Adams 16 fly. I tie flies, and this one is so small. It's like half the size of your little fingernail, and that big guy just... And it is catch and release. People keep asking me how it tasted, and this is not what this is for. This is just fun and catching them. So,
just why he got that big.
I just had to share that. This is the guy that helped. He was trying to show me how to hold it, but it just kept falling on the ground. But anyway.
Great. It was slippery.
It's pretty good you didn't kill it, drop it.
I know. That's my report.
Thank you. Board Member Durham, do you have a report? Yeah, top that way.
Fish I caught was this big. I did have the opportunity about a week and a half ago to, I was invited to speak to a number of officers of the Colorado National Guard about education issues. It was really a great opportunity to, all of them, almost all of them have families with children in Colorado. They're all very concerned about education. Obviously, they have significant duties sometimes that take them outside the state, and it was a great opportunity to hear their concerns about Colorado education and to answer questions about where the state's headed and what kind of progress we might be making. So that's probably the best opportunity I've had to relate to people that I think do a lot for the state of Colorado about what we're trying to do to help them.
Thank you. Board Member Flores.
I had a chance to speak to a social justice committee group, which is interested in looking into the confinement of children in jail or special jails for juveniles. And we're surprised to learn that 10-year-old kids and 11-year-old kids were confined. And I think that there was enough interest that there are several committees, I think, within Denver that are where people are looking into this. And I think we need to really consider this whole issue of kids who are placed in detention centers because they cannot attend schools, given the problems that exist for transportation. And it also giving giving mind to parents who can't really attend court hearings to help represent their kids, and because of their immigrants, and they're scared, and there's a lot of fear out in many of our communities because of this. And so I just can't tell you enough how sad it is that for instance, that kids are put in detention centers, and for a parent to feel so helpless that, you know, but know that there might be repercussions for attending and representing their child in court. So anyway, that's it for me. Thank you.
I had attended an interesting presentation by Donald Kay, Educator Housing Summit, and what they've done is, what they did was invite a number of different organizations that are working to help provide affordable housing for teachers. Some of it was rural. So in some cases it was providing housing with reduced rents, and in other cases it was housing where either there was a grant for a part of a down payment or a less expensive housing opportunity that's basically affordable housing, so that when the teachers move out, the appreciation is limited, just as typical affordable housing is done so. But I thought it was kind of impressive that around the state, school districts are attending to the challenges of providing housing for teachers because they really can't afford it. What I found interesting is that many school districts of any kind of size do have excess land, and they are now working in partnership with the banks in their communities, businesses in their communities, to really put together the funding in order to provide the opportunities for either rental properties or purchase properties, or in some cases both. Roaring Fork has a pretty extensive effort. Custer County has some apartments that they are finishing. I think it was Custer County example, the high school students are actually finishing a building that they happened to acquire or was given to them. They're turning it into four different apartments as part of their curriculum. It was very encouraging. One of the joys, I think, of local control is that pretty soon you just roll up your sleeves and figure out some way to address your most critical problem, and housing is definitely one of the most critical problems for our rural communities, because there isn't very much housing, period, and what is affordable is too expensive, particularly not just in the resort areas, but there are so many retirees who are moving to Colorado to these small towns that they too are
essentially raising the cost of the housing that's available, and so our teachers can't afford it. It was a great presentation. You might want to look on Donald K. website if you want to learn more about it. I did attend the first CASB regional meeting, and as I hope I wrote you, I was on the fly asked to talk about the state board and what we were doing and answer questions. There were, it was a yikes, but it was fine. There was a lot of interest in the opt-out. There's some concern, there's more awareness all of a sudden among school board members that the information, you know, their staff gave them a presentation on the results of the assessments, but they were frustrated by the lack of conclusions that they could reach by some of them. I also heard a number of kudos to the department for the kind of support. The one that I attended had both fourth CD and second CD school board members. And so I have a hunch there were some Greeley folks there. I'm not sure, but there were a lot of compliments that came specifically to Ms. Pearson and the field services department and to Katie as well. So I think the department is definitely being recognized as something other than purely a regulatory agency, which it's taken a long time. Katie and I attended the Colorado Rises launch yesterday as she presented. What I'm here to tell you is that Deb Scheffel sends her greetings. Oh. She was there. Superintendent Munn was there, and boy, was he cheerful and friendly and happy. So one of the nice things about, in addition to hearing a little bit about the launch, was also to see a number of people who are really dedicated to Colorado kids. And Deb looked great and introduced me to we actually had a consent item today on our agenda for a program, so I met some of her colleagues, or one of her colleagues, I should say. It was a great presentation. I guess the one other comment I would make in response to Board Member Rankin's comment about financial transparency, I have used that when folks have said to me, well, such and such school spends money or gets money, and I've said, well, let's go look and look it up. And I agree with you. I expected it on the front page. I'm not the best about going through this stuff, and I also had to go through the finance, and so I would second that request that it be on the top, because it really inspired the few people that I did this with to go, oh, I didn't know I could do this. And then I actually had to write out for them the process to get into that. It would be nice. It would be probably easier if it were just right on the front page. So, okay, great. Thank you.
They're going to put you in jail.
Huh?
They're going to put you in jail because of what you did. Discussing an item that was to be decided.
Oh,
what?
You approved it.
What?
You already approved it.
We already approved it.
Oh, ahead of time. Oh.
So the next part.
Couldn't help it.
I don't know what you're talking about, but we'll talk about that later. It's not new. So we have another session of public participation. Do we have any? Oh.
Oh.
In that case,
well,
I would.
Think this is the caterer walking in. We can all applaud. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Masnick. Yeah, the food's been great. So we'll stand in adjournment until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Thank you, folks.